Hello and welcome to Muskegon History and Beyond with the Lakeshore Museum Center. My name is Pat Horn, and joining me today is Wendy Van Workum. And today is going to be a hopefully mostly spoiler-free conversation centered around the book Firekeeper's Daughter by Angeline Bouley. Now, this episode is in part because the Lakeshore Museum Center and Hackley Public Library are working together on the Great Michigan Read, which picks a book every year to talk about and spread throughout the state, and this year happens to be Firekeeper's Daughter. Now, if you haven't read this book yet, which you should, it's a great book. I think Wendy and I agree on that. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't plan to, this episode is still for you because we're going to be covering many topics and issues related to Native Americans that I think you'll find very informative. Now, Wendy and I aren't really scripting anything here, so we're going to be kind of meandering around a little bit, but hopefully this conversation will be really interesting about a little bit about the book, but also about Native American culture and traditions and kind of how Native Americans are seen and portrayed in our world today as well. All right, Wendy, so where do we want to start with this book? I mean, I think, first of all, just to say me a little more about it, the book is geared towards young adults, but I think kind of a more older young adult.
Yeah, I would say like 15 and over is probably where it probably sits the best. But certainly, if you're a parent and you have questions, read it yourself first. You will like it and be entertained by it, and then you can make your own choice on that.
And the book really centers around a young 18-year-old girl named Donis Fontaine, who is part French-Canadian kind of heritage, and then the other part is Ojibwa heritage. And so it kind of revolves around her story and her life being kind of trapped between two worlds here, not really fitting into either one, but then that being compounded by some issues in her Native American community, and then that being tied into an investigation by the FBI and a new drug that's being passed around. And it all ties together in really interesting ways.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about this book is that you don't often find many books that are about Native Americans by Native Americans and have a Native American main character. And I think that the author does a fabulous job of just having Donis's Native American heritage being a part of the book, but it's just there very organically, and yeah, it makes it fun to read. And she brings up a lot of really challenging issues that surround the Native American community sometimes. And she does it in such a way that you're really interested and excited and makes you want to learn more. Like, even after you're done with the book, I know that we've had conversations about being curious about more.
One of the things I'll say too, so I've actually listened to her talk twice about the book, and what's kind of interesting is there's a lot of this Native American culture just weaved into the story really seamlessly. But part of that is she did kind of tweak and make up things a little bit as well. And part of the reason why she did that, she mentioned, is that Native American culture kind of keeps within that culture. They don't want to share everything that they're doing, their kind of traditional teachings and things like that. So it's kind of interesting too, where there's these kind of aspects where she tweaked things a little bit. There's still tons of information you can learn from the book.
Yeah, she's very open about that fact, that it's a very difficult position to be in. You know, how much do you share and how much do you not share? We've been fortunate in that here at the museum, when we work with different community members, they typically are more than willing to share some of the more common stuff. One of the things that she did share in the book that was really neat is the way the book is arranged. It actually follows the medicine wheel that they have, or one of them. And she did that very purposefully and intentionally, because it also follows the character arc if you can tip it on its side. And so that's why each of the sections will have a direction, and it has the Anishinaabeg name for that section of the wheel, and there's different things that are highlighted on it, which I thought was a really cool and interesting way to arrange the book in a very intentional way that kind of just makes it the way that it is. It's hard to describe how cool it is. But.
And one of the things I know too, so she's actually written a second book, which is already out, Were Girl Unearthed. And so she said that she's doing four books in a series, and they're going to represent the four different elements. That's tied into that same kind of medicine wheel idea. All right, so one of the things I know I really loved about the book, and I found really interesting, we kind of talked about weaving in this stuff here, is the language that's used in there. So she, every once in a while, drops in on the main character, Donis, there. She throws out the English word for things, and then sometimes also the Ojibwa word for things. Or sometimes I think she uses the Ojibwa words, and you have to either by context kind of put together, or sometimes you're like, I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I'm intrigued. And you can do a little research or try to see if it pops up later in the story. And I found that just really fun to try and learn some new words.
Yeah, and she said when you listen to her talk that she did that very intentionally so that it doesn't make a big deal of the language. It's kind of just like Donna's Native American heritage. It just is what it is, and it's there because they talk a lot about, like, I can't remember which book it's in, if it's in Firekeeper's Daughter or Warrior Girl on Earth, but that you dream in the language. Like, when are you fluent? It's when you dream in the language, which is really interesting. And she quotes Robin Kimmer, who did Braiding with Sweetgrass in the book, and she quotes a couple of other authors in the book. And Robin Kimmer talks a lot about language and how it matters, and that there's so much more meaning attached to it, and just this idea of having diversity of thought and blending together indigenous knowledge along with science.
And kind of tying this in, we mentioned this is part of the Great Michigan Read program that the museum and library are doing. So one of the things that we've actually already done here at the museum is tied in some Ojibwa words into our exhibits and displays, kind of like they're sprinkled throughout this book. So potentially indefinitely, some of these labels are going to be up. So you'll see things like beaver and then what the Ojibwa word for beaver is, paying homage to that use of the language in the book.
And there are QR codes with those signs so you can scan it and hear a native speaker pronouncing them, because admittedly, I will not do well with pronunciations, and I know that I don't. But I think it's really amazing that so many people are trying to keep the language alive and in use.
So I think one of the next things we kind of need to set up a little bit is Indian land or reservations, because that ties into some of the other things that happen in the book here. So I guess where do we want to start diving into that? I mean, it's a very complex issue and it varies a lot from tribe to tribe, location to location.
Yeah, I think one of the places to start is in the context of the book. It has a lot to do with law enforcement, just by nature of what the book is about. Like, who has the right to kind of interpret and enforce laws, both on the reservation and off the reservation, both with enrolled tribal members and non-enrolled tribal members, and people that aren't associated with the tribe at all.
Yeah, there's a few things I want to touch on there. So enrolled tribal members versus non-enrolled, right? One of the kind of things that comes up in the book there is Donna's, because she's mixed heritage here, she's not technically enrolled in the tribe. So she's somewhat an outsider, but not fully. And so for different tribes, there's different ways you can be a member of that tribe. So some tribes have what's called the blood quantum. So you have to have a certain percentage of heritage tied into a Native American bloodline to qualify to be an enrolled member. Some it's just you have to have one ancestor and be able to prove that in some way through census data. I think the U.S. government has boarding house school records, too, that can be used for tribes for that qualification. So that's something that does kind of crop up in the book there, is Donna's trying to find her place within the tribe, even though she's not technically enrolled within that tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing, too, so with the reservation here, we should mention, too, that this book, part of why it's the Great Michigan Read book, is because it takes place in Sault Ste. Marie, an area called Sugar Island, kind of between Canada and the UP there. So it's based on a real location, but names and some details have been changed around a little bit. That's kind of one of those things that she tweaked a little bit for this book. But that area, they are a federally recognized tribe, which meant in the past, right, they had made some kind of official agreement with the United States government. That's one of the things that tribes, I know the tribe around Muskegon here, has struggled with having federal recognition, even though they have local recognition as far as the state, but not every tribe is federally recognized. That doesn't mean they're not a tribe, but there wasn't some kind of formal agreement between the government. So in the story, this tribe is one that has a formal agreement, so they have a formal reservation land, which is then why you get things like law enforcement that is tribal police versus local police, and those two don't necessarily mix. But that's kind of where the book ties into the FBI, right? So in most reservation lands, the tribal police take care of just about everything except for high-level felonies and things like murder, in which then the FBI is usually called in to do that investigation. And so without spoiling how it all goes together here, that kind of ties into how she becomes involved with the FBI. And that's just kind of a really interesting thing that we've talked about, how you have that local police divide and that federal police and the tribal police trying to all work together, but not necessarily.
Right. Yeah. And it really comes down to issues of sovereignty. And those, that there's a lot of really interesting conversations regarding sovereignty and Native Americans and the reservations and everything. And a lot of these reservations were established by treaties with the federal government. And there's also treaty rights attached to those involving all sorts of things like fishing and hunting and gathering and just all sorts of threads that are woven throughout a community. And it also has to do with the casinos, because they talk about the casinos in the book and things like that. And so the ability of Native Americans to have casinos on reservation land plays a part in that, too.
And I think that's something we can talk a little bit about with the book, because Donis's brother is, or half-brother, I guess, he is a member of the tribe, and he receives what's called a per capita. So some tribes, their casinos actually pay a big dividend, basically, to all the members of the tribe. Not all do that, but some do. And so that's one of the things that being an enrolled member of the tribe is a nice thing that, you know, you get. It's a certain set amount of money every year, month. I don't remember how they, how it's doled out.
I have a feeling it's one of those things that probably is, it varies widely depending on where you live and what group you're in.
I think that's kind of one of the things, too, you know, the book tries to tackle a little bit of these kind of preconceptions about Native Americans and how things work. You know, I think people tend to associate Native Americans with casinos and think every tribe has their casino and they have all this casino money that they pass out. But that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes it is like that, but not often.
Yeah, it talks a lot about perceptions of the non-Native American community and perceptions of the Native American community. Because even in the very beginning of the book, Donis addresses the fact that she and her friend have different color tone skin and that that matters in their community and outside their community. And again, it's just a nod to that fact that throughout a lot of the book, she struggles with the fact that she straddles these two different parts of her heritage. One of the things that I really, really enjoyed in the book was the repeated touching on the fact that elders in a in the Native American community are so important. Donis talks a lot about them, a lot about her Grand Mary, which is her grandmother on her mother's side, who is not Native, but is clearly still cherished in a way that I think is reflective of her Native American heritage. And then as well as her other grandma, who is Native American, as well as other elders in the community. She talks a lot about how knowledge transmission happens in a Native community, which is a little bit different than, say, a traditional, more Western idea of school. Like, you go to school, you read a book, you learn. Whereas in the Native American community, one of the things highlighted in the book is that you talk to your elders and you spend time with your elders and you purposefully go out and do things with your elders. And I just think that's a beautiful thing to show in the book. And I think she does it really well.
And I was going to actually bring up, too, this is a perfect jumping off point. In the book, Donis talks about the gifts of the seven grandfathers. Once again, respecting the elders. But one of the gifts is to, you know, respect all yourself and others, but also all living beings. It's kind of like a mantra she does almost every morning. Mm-hmm. She kind of recites those seven gifts there. So it's respect, love, truth, bravery, wisdom, humility, and honesty as kind of your cornerstones to try and live up to every day. I don't want to go too much into the second book, but one of the things in the second book is, too, that learning from elders is the kids all, I think they're 15, 14 or so, and they all kind of get assigned to different roles with elder people in their community to learn certain kind of jobs or roles. So you see that again in the second book, and that leads to a really interesting story in the second book, which we'll probably talk about because it talks about some interesting issues, particularly centered around NAGPRA. If you've never heard of that before, that's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Basically, to shorten it, it was a law that was passed to help repatriate Native American remains and grave goods that had been dug up by archaeologists and anthropologists in the past and to give those back to the tribes or communities they came from, and oftentimes led to reburials of those bones or grave goods.
Yeah, which has a lot of implications for us as a museum and an institution, because we actually had gone, we've gone through that process with our collection. So yeah, it is definitely interesting. And I'm sure you all can look forward to another podcast on that. Keeping with the elders and things, the museum has hosted in the past powwows at various times throughout the organization's history. And, you know, when you think about Native Americans sharing their culture, that is one of the places where they very openly share, and it's really neat. And if you ever get a chance to attend a powwow, there are a number that happen in the community. There's one in Hart, there's one in Grand Rapids, there's one at Grand Valley. We highly encourage you to do that because you will learn a lot, and they always have special times to honor elders, veterans, and it's just really powerful to see that. And it's very, we're very grateful that they share that.
Yeah, agreed. And actually, that kind of brings up another thing, too, that's tied in the book, and that's certain gala that you wear at a powwow and different ceremonies. So in the book, there are a few ceremonies that take place that Donis is a part of or is watching. I think one or two of them are kind of more the author kind of made up or tweaked certain ceremonies to not share that information with outsiders. But what you wear at those ceremonies is reflective of life experience, you know, things you're known for, that kind of thing, which is really, it's an interesting way to help your identity, you know, who you are, what you've experienced, that, and let other people see that. So I think it's kind of neat the way that's done. And she kind of talks a little bit about getting certain things or wearing certain things.
Yeah. And I think that goes a long way because a lot of times, you know, today people are changing mascots and people are advocating for not having Native American costumes as a part of Halloween, which, and you'll notice Patrick very purposefully said regalia because that's what it is. It's not a costume. They don't wear costumes. They wear regalia. And a lot of these regalia are really intricate and something that is kind of compiled over your lifetime. It might be something that's gifted to you or parts of it are gifted to you. In the case of jingle dresses, that's something that you spend, I think, almost an entire year making, depending on the type of regalia you might have. And that's why it's good to have these books, because it shows you an honest depiction of what a Native American person is like today in this time. Because so many times, even here at the museum, we get kids who go to school and learn about Native Americans, and they don't realize that they're still in the present community and what that looks like, yeah, because they're so used to only learning about the historic community.
Yeah, exactly right. And one of the things about this book, and so it's set, I think, around 2001, late 90s, I think somewhere around there, mm-hmm. she said. So it's about Native Americans living in the active community. And Donna's one of the big things is she's a hockey player. She lives in the UP. Mm-hmm. Hockey's a big deal. So hockey's a theme that ties in, you know, and showing, yeah, they're living in our community. They're around. They're doing the same things. Mm-hmm. It's... yeah, she has this kind of Native American side that does some things a little bit differently, but mm-hmm. there's also hockey. You know, everyone loves hockey up there. It's, right. it's something that everyone does. It doesn't matter who you are. And that really ties into kind of who she is and part of the story as well, without saying too much more about it. But
yeah, and the other nice thing is that even though we've kind of addressed some of the issues that crop up in the Native American community, the book also addresses some pretty universal truths for young people and issues that they might have. And I'm not going to go into it any more than that because it'll spoil it. But I think that Donis as a main character is extremely relatable. And like I said, I think that even though she is a Native American, in the context of having a book about a Native American main character is huge. Because I think I was listening to a talk, and I think it's like only 1% of books released in a year are about Native Americans.
Yeah, it's a very low number. Native Americans.
Yeah. It's a very small, small percentage. And so to have it written so well where it's just not a big deal, it's just who she is, and the writing just totally draws you in. And I literally, I don't know about you, Pat, but I literally could not put it down. I think I read it in about 3 days.
Yeah, I definitely had some times where I was like, I need to be doing something else, but I got one more chapter, that's it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's definitely hard to put down. You mentioned there's not a lot of Native American authors publishing books about Native Americans. One of the cool things about this story, and hopefully it helps sell it to you if you're on the fence about reading or not, but the book has actually been picked up by the Obama's production company. So they made a production company, and I think it's going to be on Netflix, I believe. They're turning it into, a mini series. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be out there on streaming services. It's a really good story. People really like it. But one of the things that Angeline Bouley wanted is that a certain percentage of those working on that show had to be Native American or have Native American cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. So they could give their input and say, we can't show this part. She really was harping on that she wanted Native Americans involved in this for a variety of reasons, to give their voices as well, and to help encourage the growth of more Native Americans in the entertainment industry. So I guess going back to some of the more kind of cultural and heritage things, certain plants play an important role in this story for a few different reasons. But I don't know if, Wendy, if you want to touch on some of the medicine wheel there and some of the plants that are involved with that.
Yeah. In our interactions with the Native American community and also just through via the book, you kind of have your four big medicines, I would say, that get talked about a lot. It's not that they're the only ones. They just get talked about a lot and they're emphasized quite a bit in the book. And that is sweetgrass, tobacco, cedar, and also sage. And they're used for different things. So like, say I mentioned earlier that the museum had hosted the powwow. So there are certain things, places where we have cedar boughs in the circle, and there was always tobacco that was at the entrance to the circle where people would come in and then dance. They use sage in different ways and also sweetgrass. And so those are really cool. And Donna does that in the book. Yeah. There's different times where she puts different things. I think in one part of the book, she puts cedar in her shoe. She'll always offer tobacco when she goes on the ferry and goes across the water.
You call it SEMA, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And sweetgrass shows up. You know, Angeline Boulay referenced that Braiding Sweetgrass book, and that has things about that. So yeah, like I said, it's a really beautiful thing. And it's very clear in the book that those are not the only, what they would say, medicines, but that those are kind of the big four that we will often hear. If you hear about them, you will hear about those a lot of times.
And she talks about, Sugar Island, this place that's kind of their reservation area, this island between the U.S. and Canada. A lot of those plants grow there, and you can go there and, you know, harvest them and pick them. And that plants play a really important role in the story and in Native American culture and traditions as well. One other thing I want to talk about too with culture and tradition. So the title of the book, Firekeeper's Daughter, the author is actually daughter of a firekeeper. So in the tribes here, the firekeeper is a pretty important role. So fire is used for a lot of the ceremonies. So when someone dies, there's a fire kept up during that mourning kind of process. And so whoever's the firekeeper is going to making sure it doesn't burn out ever. And so that is a really important role or position within the story. So it's kind of neat that she picked that title kind of to honor her father who served that role, but also goes to the story as well and some of the things that happened during it. Fire is brought up as something that's important for the culture. Things like sweat lodges too are used to kind of help purify or cleanse the body before certain ceremonies or after certain events.
Yeah, and when she talks about the book every once in a while, at least at one time that she was speaking, she mentioned being with her dad while he was tending the fire at one of these ceremonies and keeping in company and just talking with him and just saying that he shared at those times things with her that he had never shared any other time. And again, I think that highlights not only the importance of that position, but just how you share knowledge in that community a lot of times, which makes it pretty special. One thing to think about is Patrick and I have mentioned that Native Americans as characters, as authors, there's just not a high percentage of them that show up in literature. So if you are, if you enjoy this book, you want to read more books that you know are going to give you a really good, accurate portrayal or a really good quality books about Native Americans, there is a blog called American Indians and Children's Literature that was established by Dr. Debbie Reese. And you can go there and she gives reviews of different books, either by Native authors, about Native Americans. There's fiction, there's nonfiction. There are books like this one that's for young adults and right on down through board books for really, really young readers. So if this is an interest for you, we encourage you to go there and look for some really good quality books, because just like every portrayal of anything in life in public and in media isn't always accurate, this is the case here, and this is the place you can go to know that you're getting some really good recommendations.
One of the things, too, with law enforcement, there's tribal police, and then there's local police that don't go on the reservations necessarily. The FBI having to investigate any kind of major crimes on a reservation is that a lot of times there's things that slip through the cracks. And it's something that is addressed in the book and is a real life issue as well, which you might have been hearing about. It's becoming more and more put out there and word being spread and awareness being spread about it. But that's violence against Native American women. It's something that you're going to hear about in the book a little bit, which is why we kind of suggest an older reader for it, because there's some pretty, you know, kind of traumatizing things that are talked about. But it's important because it's something that does happen. So in Indian country, on a reservation, a Native woman is 10 times more likely to be murdered or go missing than any other population in the United States. Which, you think about that, is just crazy, right? 10 times the number. It's huge. And it's being considered at this point in time a genocide, really, because of the numbers of Native American women that are being murdered or have gone missing, and then just no resolution to it. It's starting to become something that's more and more out there, but it's still happening, and a lot of issues evolving around it.
And it's worth talking about, and it's not isolated to any one area. It seems to be rather widespread across a lot of different reservation areas. It's here and in Canada. And some representations that you may have seen in popular media are women with the red hand over their mouth. And that's what that's for. So not something to be used lightly. And it's a pretty, like we said, it's one of those intense topics that shows up in the book, which is why we kind of say 15 or up, or parents, read it and see what your kids are reading and see if you want them to read it or not. If they're younger than that, that's up to you. It's a tough topic, but like Patrick said, it's an important one because it's happening.
And I think that's part of the reason why she included it in the book, because it is something that is important in the Native American community, and to help spread that word. And hopefully it's doing that with the book.
One of the other kind of harder topics that the book deals with in the Native American community has to do with boarding schools. These were schools where Native American children were sent, and the schools were basically trying to remove their culture. So one of the things that they were trying to do at these boarding schools is these Native American children would be taken from their communities. They would move to these residential schools, and the people who were running the schools were trying to get them to assimilate into what they considered modern Western culture. So they weren't allowed to speak their language. They weren't allowed to practice their traditions, and there were a whole lot of rules.
Couldn't dress traditionally,
had to cut their hair in a lot of places. And so for some children, a lot of these children, those were really, really traumatic experiences. Some of them were taken involuntarily from their communities. And there's just a lot of questions, I think, that people are asking about these schools that are really hard questions, and a lot of people who have been deeply wounded by them and their experience. And it's a lot of what we would call generational trauma, I guess.
And that's kind of the thing too, is a lot of these kids that went to these schools, they were separated from their families. You know, there wasn't a lot of contact between families. Some of the kids never returned. Did they die at the school? Did they run away? Those answers just were never out there. And that's something you see in the book. So Donna's grandmother attended a boarding school. And so she kind of has this this fear of federal government, about her grandchildren being taken away to some boarding school, even though they're not actively really out there anymore. But they were until the 1980s here in Michigan. There were four boarding schools in Michigan that were trying to do this assimilation. And so it went on for longer than I thought, anyway. I would have thought that by the 60s, those kind of schools were gone. But up until the 80s, they were still operating here in Michigan.
Yeah, and that's a really, really hard one to think about and talk about. So maybe we can put in the show notes a link to some more information if that's something that you're curious about, so that you can kind of learn more about that story. Because it is a really hard story, I think, and it's hard for everybody to look at.
Going along with this kind of generational trauma, one of the quotes that was really kind of stood out to me in the book, and it's in the reader's guide for this book as well that they've released for the Great Michigan Read, is that, quote, "scariest words ever spoken, I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help." That's what we've been said to in the past, you know, then you took our kids away to boarding school. And so this is something that's a scary thing. Like, they don't feel like they're being helped by the federal government. They can't trust them. It's something that definitely is a theme through the book. And I think in our real life world here as well.
We talked about the treaties earlier. I don't think that there's one that has fully been honored by the federal government. That's not even the beginning, but that's a lot of the beginning. And then you just have these things that continually happen. You've got the treaties, you've got the boarding schools, you've got what's going on with the missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's just a lot of things that make trust a hard thing when you're talking about government, law enforcement, and things like that. And I think that that's addressed in the book. If you read into it, that's not a theme that doesn't show up. And it's trusting, and it's how much you trust and what you trust them with and things like that. Because of that history, it makes it really hard, I think.
Hopefully you enjoyed our discussion about Fire Keeper's Daughter and some of the kind of the issues and themes that are brought up in the book. I will mention too, with the Great Michigan Read, as I said, it's the museum here and also Hackley Public Library are doing a few different programs and some different events as well tied into the Great Michigan Read and Fire Keeper's Daughter. So please keep your eye out on our Facebook page and our website calendars and the libraries as well for more information about some of those upcoming events. I know we're looking on some programs with some traditional foods, traditional language programs as well. So there's going to be some different activities, and I believe we're also doing a book club, too, to talk about the book. Lots of interesting discussions will be coming up around based around this book as part of the Great Michigan Read. So please do check in. And if you have anything, any comments about this episode, anything else that you found really interesting, leave us a comment and we would like to continue this discussion some more.
Yeah. And as these programs move forward, keep in mind that there are different organizations across the state that have books that are available to you for free, depending on when you're listening to this podcast. And there's going to be opportunities to download the book as well digitally, if that is how you like to consume your books. And as Patrick and I have already said, it is entirely worth the read. You really should read it. If you don't, you will be missing out.
Yeah, and I would encourage to get the actual physical book, just in part 2 because of the cover art.
Yes.
It's just, can we just talk about the cover art for a second? Because it is probably the most beautiful book I've seen. Like, I kind of picture it with, like, the illuminated, you know, manuscripts that you see out there with this kind of the beauty and the detail level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a stunning work of cover art. And I know that was done by a Native American artist that was specifically requested by the author to find that one. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. And like we said, keep an eye out for some of those upcoming programs. And then keep your ears open for a second discussion on the book Warrior Girl Unearthed eventually in the future here with some museum staff, because that one really ties into what we do on a daily basis and Native Americans and their viewpoint of museums and how museums use their culture. So that'll definitely be another interesting episode to be released in the future.